I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan for just a year, is out. That Rolling Stone article in which General McChrystal and his aides made dismissive comments about President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and other administration officials has cost him his job. President Obama, speaking a short time ago in the Rose Garden, said he didn't have a policy difference with McChrystal and he didn't have a sense of personal insult.
But war is bigger than any one man or woman, whether a private, a general, or a president. And as difficult as it is to lose General McChrystal, I believe that it is the right decision for our national security. The conduct represented in the recently published article does not meet the standard that should be set by a commanding general.
The president named the head of Central Command, General David Petraeus, to take over in Afghanistan. Julian Barnes covers the Pentagon for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from Washington. Julian, President Obama fired General David McKiernan last year to put General McChrystal in charge. And he also said today this decision to fire McChrystal made him very personally sad. He liked the guy and they shared the same policy commitment. Your thoughts on this firing?
What we see here is that the Pentagon and the White House clearly felt that something so public that sort of questioned civilian overseers of the war was simply not acceptable. And as much as they liked and respected McChrystal, as much as they believed that he was the right person for the job, they felt it was just not, they had to send a message that the civilian leadership had to be respected, and so as a result, he had to go.
And this is the military, after all, with a strict chain of command. And remind us, you know, let's remember McChrystal a little bit. He headed special ops, and under his command, al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in Iraq. He was commended for that. He also played a role in the cover-up in the death of Pat Tillman. The Rolling Stone article said that would have destroyed the career of a lesser man, and we remember McChrystal admitted that he knew days before awarding Tillman a posthumous Silver Star that Tillman had been killed by his own troops and not the enemy. So put this career in perspective.
Well, you know, his role in the Tillman thing was ambiguous. There was evidence that he sort of put more of a stop sign up than some other officers that were involved in that, and that he tried to warn senior folks. So that's not as much of a blemish as I think the Rolling Stone article made out. And it's very what you said about his role leading the Joint Special Operations Command in Iraq was very true. He was instrumental in the success of the surge there. His leadership there was really important, and they got a lot of things done. And that is why he was chosen to lead in Afghanistan. It was thought that he could do both. He could do both the sort of kill the enemy job of the special forces and also the sort of broader counterinsurgency strategy of protecting the population.
Well, two things are obvious. One, the military is probably going to think hard and fast about giving wide open interviews to magazines like Rolling Stone. And also, there are going to be questions about strategy going forward in Afghanistan. We're going to take a look at that tomorrow on the program. But we just want to ask about David Petraeus now being appointed to head up Afghanistan. David Petraeus, who just fainted this week because of dehydration just a few days ago. So what's the sense of his appointment?
Well, the sense is that it made it easier to fire McChrystal once the idea of appointing Petraeus came to light. Because once you put Petraeus in there, you have continuity. He helped craft this strategy. He's been overseeing it as head of Central Command. He has a proven track record in Iraq. He has great fans and supporters on Capitol Hill. His nomination will be very easy. He knows what's going on. They don't have to redo the strategy. By putting him in place, you don't necessarily set back the timeline as you would if you chose a general who's been less involved in Afghanistan.
That's Julian Barnes, a Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Again, President Obama announced just a while back in a Rose Garden appearance that General Stanley McChrystal is out as the head of command in Afghanistan, replaced by David Petraeus. Julian, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Well, President Obama agreed last month to send 1,200 National Guard troops to the southwest border of the U.S. to add to the more than 20,000 Border Patrol agents already there. In a minute, we're going to hear from someone who says we should focus more on visa violators, who represent about 40% of those here illegally. But first, let's turn to Arizona. Here's a campaign ad from Tea Partier J.D. Hayworth, who's challenging John McCain in an August primary for the Republican nomination for Senate.
J.D. Hayworth is the consistent conservative who will secure our border.
I'm J.D. Hayworth, and I approve this message because border security is national security.
And here's a television ad from Senator McCain, who's seen walking the border fence with Sheriff Paul Babbo of Pinal County.
Have we got the right plan?
Plan's perfect. You bring troops, state, county, and local law enforcement together.
And complete the dang fence.
About half of that dang fence is in Arizona, where closing the gaps in the border is a fierce rallying cry. But will the fence do that? Christopher Conover is senior political reporter for KUAZ Public Radio and KUAT Television in Tucson, Arizona. And Chris, the fence was started under President Bush. What's left to complete?
What's left to complete, according to the U.S. Border Patrol, is about 50 miles within Arizona. The rest of the state has some sort of fence or barrier. And when you talk to the Border Patrol and they say that that area is completed, what they're talking about, it could very well be the fence that people, at least here, becoming very familiar with, about 20 feet tall, sunken concrete. It could also be vehicle barriers, which are usually pipes that stick out of the ground to keep vehicles from coming across. And there's a small area that also has some electronic fencing, things like sensors and other types of technology. But they say there's about a 50-mile section that is not complete. When I talked to the Border Patrol about this, they said the reason that's not complete is that terrain is just so harsh. It's either completely impractical to build a fence or it forms a natural barrier all on its own.
Well, what about the fence as it stands now? The government spent $2.4 billion since 2005 to build what is there right now. Is there a sense that it works?
It certainly does slow some people down, but we have all seen the video and the pictures of people hopping that fence. When U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano was governor of Arizona, she put it in context by saying, you show me a 50-foot fence, I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. Does it slow some people down? Absolutely. Does it completely stop the problem? No. And when the fence was built in California and Texas, what it did is it really funneled a lot of people into Arizona to cross. So as the fence has been built, it has changed where the crossings take place.
Well, and you mentioned the comment about, you show me a 50-foot fence, I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. Mayor Michael Gomez of Douglas, Arizona, says somewhat the same thing. People jump right over this fence, and we understand they do. Bring ladders to the fence. What else do they do to get through and over it?
They will cut through some of it. There was a drug ring that was broken up, and they had worked out a system so they could drive vehicles over the various sections of fence. They basically had portable bridges, if you will.
Well, in fact, the Associated Press writes about these trucks with retractable vehicle ramps in the truck so that they can just roll, you know, pickups filled with marijuana over the fence and then pull up the ramp behind them.
Exactly. That kind of goes back to the argument of, if you show me a 50-foot fence, I'll show you a 51-foot ladder.
Well, former Colorado Rep. Tom Tancredo told Fox News that what's needed is a layered fence, maybe a fence, then a road, then another fence. What are some of the other suggestions for ways to, you know, prevent people from cutting through with blow torches or some crossers knock down the barriers and build lookalikes that look exactly like the steel barriers, only the lookalikes are made out of cardboard? What are some of the suggestions to get around this?
In some places, you do see the layered fence. That's something that Senator John McCain is calling for, 2-3 layers deep. You also hear a lot about unmanned aircraft, the type that are used, frankly, over in Iraq and Afghanistan, are also deployed along the Arizona border and are now being spread to other parts of the U.S. southwestern border to keep an eye on what's going on. And then if they find somebody or a group of people, they can send in Border Patrol agents from there.
Well, and is there a sense, you say, people say that even as it is, it keeps people from crossing or slows them down? Is there any way to put a number on that?
The numbers vary. There has been a drop-off in some sectors of Arizona of the number of apprehensions by the Border Patrol. Is that due to more agents on the border, or have people become more creative or better at crossing and not getting caught? That's a subject for debate. And unfortunately, the other way they look at that is the number of deaths that they have out in the desert. And that's a number that has remained fairly steady, but it does ebb and flow.
Well, and then there was, of course, the death of the rancher, Robert Krentz, who was shot to death on his property on the U.S. side of the fence. Authorities suspect the shooter was involved in smuggling. And that death helped propel the current law, which calls for police to join federal officials in tracking down illegal immigrants. But how do people in Arizona feel about the fence? It's been breached thousands of times. Every breach costs an average of $1,300 to repair. And overall, it's going to cost another $6.5 billion over the next 20 years to maintain. So do people in Arizona think it keeps them safer, or think it's a symbol of something that keeps them safer?
There's a camp of people who say the fence does no good. This is ridiculous. Why are we fighting this way? There are then those who say, look at the number of people who have been arrested. Those numbers are dropping. Therefore, the fence is working. We are all safer. I know I've talked with mayors of small towns along the border, and very often they do say, of course this fence is hopped on a regular basis, and people in our towns are nervous about who they see coming across the border. The Border Patrol has set up a checkpoint on Interstate 19, which runs from the U.S.-Mexico border up into Tucson, and a lot of the mayors and city folks in that area where they set it up were very upset when they put it up, because they said the undesirables would know exactly where the Border Patrol is, which then forces them off the interstate and into these small towns, be they the drug smugglers, the human smugglers, and people like that.
But of those who support the fence, is the general consensus that it actually does protect them?
Of those who support it, yes. They believe that it does protect them, that it does at least slow people down. So, sure, it works for them. And I think you're right. There is a bit of a symbolic part of it also. But of those who support the fence, they're big supporters of the fence. They believe it works.
Christopher Conover, senior political reporter for KUAZ Public Radio and KUAT-TV in Tucson, Arizona. Christopher, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's the border fence. But what about the people who come into the country legally and then overstay visas? That's next. And later, that cap that was containing oil on the Gulf Gusher has failed. We'll check in on the debate over a moratorium. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We just heard about the debate over the effectiveness of the U.S. border fence with Mexico. Our next guest says nearly 40% of people living in the U.S. illegally come here legally on visa or border crossing guards, and then cards, and then overstay those visas and cards. They're students, business people, or people visiting family members. But then there was also Hossam Maher Hussein Smadi, a Jordanian who overstayed his tourist visa and was accused of plotting to blow up a Dallas skyscraper. In 2003, Immigration and Customs Enforcement created a special system to track down visa violators, but it isn't working. Why? And why don't we hear more about it? Susan Martin is director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. She joins us from the NPR studios in D.C. And Susan, first of all, what are people coming to the country legally on visas supposed to do when they leave?
When they leave, they're supposed to give back the form that they received on arrival. They normally give it to the airline or the sea ship if they're going by boat, and those organizations then turn the documentation over to the government. But it's a very iffy situation. There has been legislation since 1996 that would require a more formalized exit system. And that probably could work fairly well at airports where there is an electronic system of keeping track of people. The big barrier has been at the land borders because, you know, there can be 500 million entries and exits each year. It's very difficult. Usually the people who have overstayed their visa are only identified if they come into contact with authorities through some other mechanism.
Why isn't it that there is some way to set up a flag so that you know that a visa is supposed to last 90 days? When that paper isn't returned, that's flagged.
Well, it actually is flagged. And what happens is that once there is a determination that somebody hasn't gone back, that information is entered into the watch list. So if, for example, somebody then eventually does leave but wants to get a new visa to come back into the United States, they would appear on the watch list. The problem is that if they remain in the United States, there aren't the resources to track them down and find them.
Right. The red flag will go off that this person has not left the country and turned in their piece of paper, but the special unit that tracks these visas has maybe a couple hundred people assigned to going out and finding those flags.
Right. And the other thing is that that unit is much more likely to be focusing on people who were apprehended, who were determined to be deportable and then disappeared, because they're a much higher priority because we know that they have committed a violation.
I guess it seems so important because that new special unit that we mentioned that's supposed to track people who've overstayed their visas has about $70 million in funding. That's compared with a total budget for Immigration and Customs Enforcement of more than $5 billion, so it's just a fraction of that total. And there are only about a couple hundred people assigned to tracking down visa violators as opposed to more than 20,000 Border Patrol agents. But also it feels as if further, you know, the vilification of illegal immigrants, the anger is directed at laborers and people who might have come in through Mexico, when in fact, it sounds as if many of the people in the country illegally might be the students that you're walking with or people you're working next to.
That's certainly true. And it really points out the fact that the overemphasis on border enforcement is very short-sighted. It is important to make sure that we have the southern border fully staffed, but we do need to deal with the reasons that people overstay their visas as well. And largely those reasons are that they are looking for employment in the United States. And we spend very little in the way of resources in ensuring that people who don't have authorization to work cannot get jobs.
Well, the government's E-Verify program was set up in the late 90s. How is the idea of employers checking on documentation? How is that going?
Well, employment verification is absolutely essential. E-Verify was originally set up as a pilot program. It's never been adopted by legislation. It still has a lot of problems in that there are no biometrics. So an employer basically gives a name and social security number, and if those match, the employer is then authorized to hire the person who's just applied for a job. But people can make up real names and social security numbers. So in order for E-Verify to work, we have to have a much, much better system by which employers can determine who is legally authorized to work in the country.
Republican John McCain of Arizona is one of several politicians who's walked along the unfinished fence along the border with Arizona, and he has called visa overstays a serious problem, but certainly not along the lines of what is happening on our border. As you've said, it's, you know, almost the same number of people overstaying visas and being in the country without documentation. Why do you think it is that this problem isn't talked about as much?
I think because there's a basic ambivalence about illegal immigration in the country. It's good sound bites if you rail against it. But on the other hand, a lot of the work that people who are here illegally are doing means we have cheaper fruits and vegetables. It means we have people to do our construction work. And so we want to stop it at the border, but we really don't want to deal with the work site.
Well, I guess, too, I mean, you know, those are more than likely people who have come across the border. The people we're talking about, it sounds as if, you know, have white-collar jobs.
Not necessarily. No? They may be really overeducated for the type of jobs they're taking, but because they don't have legal permission to be here and work, they're very often doing jobs that are well below their educational level.
Are there other countries that have more success at tracking this?
Probably Australia has the best record, but Australia is an island. Most other countries with long land borders do have problems with the kind of border problems we have, but also have problems with people coming in on visas, not really with the intention of just visiting, but with the intention of working.
Susan Martin, director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. She's also fellow of the Center of Justice there. Susan's been speaking about people who come into the U.S. on visas and overstay their visit. Susan, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Russian government is pushing a bill through Parliament which critics say would give the country's main intelligence agency, the FSB, powers similar to those once held by the KGB during the days of the Soviet Union, when almost all opponents of the communist regime were ruthlessly silenced. The bill has been described by Russia's top human rights officials as one of the most dangerous pieces of legislation to be put before Parliament, but the Russian government says it's needed to tackle extremism. The BBC's Moscow correspondent Richard Galpin prepared this report.
Holding anti-government protests like this one in Moscow last month is already extremely risky for opposition groups. Like so many other rallies before, it was soon broken up by riot police, who arrested more than 150 people. But if Parliament passes the legislation now before it, increasing the powers of the intelligence agency, the FSB, then opposition activists may not even be able to leave their homes to take part in protests, because the FSB will be able to summon individuals in advance for questioning, warn them against what it calls extremist activity and the possibility of committing a crime. If the warning's ignored, it could lead to 15 days' detention. This is hospital number 29 here in Moscow, and I've come to meet an opposition activist, Alexander Artemyev, who was arrested during that demonstration on May the 31st and had his arm badly broken by the police. Now, given his experience, how does he feel about the plans to substantially increase the powers of the main intelligence agency, the FSB?
In the worst case, it will not be a crime prevention, it will be preventive terror against the opponents of the government and of the officials. Because first of all, you don't have to commit any crime in the view of the authorities. You just have to oppose the policy of the current officials to be, with much more probability, under this umbrella of the secret services.
Well, also visiting Alexander today in the hospital is his mother, Yelena. And last winter, she was visited by two agents from the FSB who wanted her to give information about her son's activities.
They warned me I might have problems because my son is involved in politics. So now you ask if I am scared by the new law. No, definitely not. And I would still not give the FSB any information about my son. We survived the Great Terror of 1937 under Stalin. We went through this already.
In front of me now is the rather grey Parliament building where the legislation has already passed its first reading. We've come to meet a prominent MP, Gennady Gudkov, who's a former KGB agent. But he's horrified by the legislation, which would give the Secret Services today the power to question and warn people on the suspicion they may at some time in the future break the law.
It was one of preventative measures of KGB in the Soviet Union, but it's absolutely not normal now in modern conditions, because we now have several parties, several deputy groups in State Duma and different mass media which stand for different political points of view.
Mr. Gudkov believes the legislation as it stands is wide open to abuse because it's so vague. But Vladimir Kolesnikov, a senior member of the ruling United Russia Party, denies it would be used to target opponents of the government or journalists. Instead, it's needed, he says, to tackle the growing number of extremists in the country.
Protesting is everybody's constitutional right, But when you are protesting, you shouldn't have a grenade or a knife in your pocket. And if you're about to put together a bomb, this is where an FSB officer will step in and say, stop. You are one step away from committing a crime.
But there are many here who are deeply suspicious of this legislation, fearing it would be another big step back to the days of repression in the Soviet Union.
That report from the BBC's Moscow correspondent Richard Galpin. Well, up next, two points of view about that preliminary ban on the ban on deep-sea exploratory drilling in the Gulf of Mexico as that containment cap on the gushing well seems to have failed today. We'll have that in 30 seconds, here and now. BP has been forced to remove that cap that was containing oil from the Gulf Gusher after an underwater robot bumped into the venting system. Crews are working on the problem. Meanwhile, the Obama administration is preparing its appeal after a federal judge struck down its six-month moratorium on deep-sea exploratory drilling, saying the government didn't make its case. Separately, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says he will issue a new order making a better case for a ban. Earlier today, we spoke with people on both sides of the issue. First, Ethan Manuel. He's an offshore drilling expert with the Sierra Club, which is taking part in the government's appeal. We asked him, why did the government fail here? Why did the government have to make their case clearer?
Well, that's a good question. We think it's a pretty open and shut case. When you look at the history of the way MMS has permitted deep water drilling, and the fact that the track record now is pretty suspect when you look at the Deepwater Horizon spill and the lack of blow-up preventers, I think it shows how entrenched and powerful the oil industry is in that part of the country.
Well, do you have questions about the decision in that regard?
Well, we do. I mean, it's just mind-boggling that this well hasn't even been capped yet. At a minimum, we need a timeout.
Well, the judge noted that some of the experts that were cited by Interior Secretary Ken Salazar in his order for a moratorium felt that they were misrepresented. These scientists said that they were only in favor of a partial ban, but Ken Salazar positioned them as being in favor of a blanket moratorium.
Well, I think the biggest fact is that there's been a cookie-cutter approach to permitting deepwater drilling. All the permits look the same. A lot of them reference animals that live in Alaska.
The walruses.
Yeah, the walruses, yeah. And the polar bears and stuff that are all in here. So I think what this case shows is that there hasn't been a very rigorous approach to permitting deepwater drilling. When you look at how the government's operated, they've always given the oil industry what they want and haven't questioned any of their plans.
So what happens now? This was just a preliminary decision. The plaintiffs in the case, the people who run a company that service exploratory rigs, can take this to trial if they want. But everyone agrees that that's going to take so much time that it makes it a moot point. So some experts following this, law professors, for instance, are saying, why not make a compromise? Do something to get the 33 offshore exploratory rigs safer?
Well, I think right now, I mean, the moderate position, the thoughtful position is to have a timeout and to reassess how we do things. We think it's just folly to go forward to allow more deep water drilling until we figure out why this rig exploded, why we had such bad cleanup plans in place, and give us time to reassess the entire program.
And you know what people on the other side of the issue say? If you take a timeout, these rigs are going to pick up and go to other countries, Brazil, for instance, because they can't afford to be idle.
Well, I think that's kind of a weird argument. I mean, the oil is still going to be there in 6 months or a year or 2 years. I mean, the oil is not going to go anywhere.
But the rigs will.
Well, but the rigs will always come back to the oil. I mean, this whole business is predicated on getting oil out of the ground. And so if there's oil underneath the coast, they're going to go get it eventually. But we think we're looking at the wrong end of the telescope here. We think this is a very eloquent reason why we need to get off of oil altogether. These coastal economies and coastal ecosystems have been devastated, and there's more jobs associated, for instance, with commercial and recreational fishing in the Gulf Coast than there are with oil and gas drilling. So we need to use this as a wake-up call to get off of oil.
But this federal judge is a Reagan-era appointee who lives in the area, at least in 2008, had some investments in some of the very companies involved in this drilling. He needs to hear from you why he should put thousands of rig workers out of work for 6 months.
The government especially needs to be more rigorous in putting forth the case that the entire offshore drilling program run by the Minerals Management Service was broken and was way too favorable to the oil industry. I think we can make that case, show that a timeout is warranted here for us to reassess how we do things off of our coasts.
Ethan Manuel, offshore drilling expert for the Sierra Club. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
We now turn to Rob Vosbeen, VP of Harvey Gulf International. You might remember we spoke with the company's CEO last week. They service rigs. And Rob, we just heard the Sierra Club admitting that the administration didn't do enough to make its case against drilling. And we saw the report this week from Transocean that showed that the blowout preventers on rigs can have a 50% failure rate. Do you think there should be some kind of timeout to ensure that rig operators, you know, get a backup for their backup? Because another blowout will wipe out your business, you know, maybe for more than 6 months.
I don't agree that there needs to be a timeout industry-wide. All of the investigation really has shown that there is no systemic-wide safety problem. The blowout preventers, there's nothing wrong with looking into this. There's nothing wrong with creating more regulations. What is a problem is stopping all the work that's ongoing at the same time. That's not how we do it in connection with airlines or mining, unless we see something that looks to be a problem that could be industry-wide.
Can you explain to us also, why does it affect your workers so much? Because the ban that the government wanted only affected the 33 exploratory deep-sea wells. It doesn't affect the hundreds, or maybe 3,600 platforms in the Gulf that are already pumping oil.
These are platforms that have long ago, the wells have been drilled, completed, they're producing, and the work to maintain them is relatively minor. There's nothing to show an industry-wide problem, and yet you're stopping the industry because the ramifications of one event are so terrible.
And you're willing to take that chance. I guess that's what people outside of the region are wondering. You know, this is it's your industry that gets hurt if there is another blowout, but you say, or even some accident that, you know, we can't even imagine, and you are willing to take that chance.
The answer is yes. You know, we have a lot of safety regulations. We have a lot of safety equipment. We spend a lot of time focusing on that. The industry is very, very conscious and aggressive with safety.
How are you feeling about this industry that you service and rely on and what we have found out about mistakes that were made, you know, emails sent about something being a nightmare well, you know, all the stuff that's been uncovered? Doesn't that make you a little distrustful of this industry that you depend on?
Not the industry, no. What I'm seeing is emails coming from, you know, that are in the news that are coming from one company. So it really is disheartening for us because it risks our company and certainly a lot of our wonderful employees, because it's not 6 months, because trust me, we tow the drilling rigs as part of our service. And we know that once those get towed, they're not coming back anytime soon. They're just going to go to Brazil or Africa, and you're not going to have anything to drill with.
You know, is it time, do you talk at all about, do we look at another industry besides oil?
I completely support that, and I think it's wonderful. But you have to be realistic in that every day, all those same people who are saying that drove to work in their car for the most part, and they're talking on their cell phone. I mean, that cell phone's made of oil. They're consuming it just like the rest of us.
That's Rob Vosbeen, VP of Harvey Gulf International. They service rigs in the Gulf. Rob, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
It's summer. Young and not so young adventurers may be looking for a hammock or under the covers with a flashlight read. May we suggest Rafe Larson's The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet, a novel just released in paperback. This acclaimed book launched a bidding war last year. In it, Larson gives us Tecumseh Sparrow Spivet, a 12-year-old Montana boy who attempts to bring order to his world by drawing maps, beautiful, highly calibrated creations which he keeps in his room in a system that can be rather perilous.
All of my notebooks were color-coded. The blue notebooks that neatly line the south wall of my room were reserved for maps of people doing things, as opposed to the green notebooks on the east wall, which contained zoological, geological, and topographical maps, or the red notebooks on the west wall, which was where I mapped out insect anatomy in case my mother, Dr. Claire Lineker Spivet, ever called upon my services. I had once tried lining maps on the north wall of my room, but in my excitement to organize, I briefly forgot that this was where the entrance to my room was located, and when Dr. Claire opened the door to announce that dinner was ready, the bookshelf fell on my head.
Author Rafe Larson reading from The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet, a novel. Dr. Claire, T.S.'s mother, is a distracted entomologist. His father, a gruff cowboy, Are they normally so distant, or are they still in shock after T.S.'s beloved older brother Leighton died in that shooting accident in the barn? We won't know till after T.S. hops a freight train from his family ranch in Montana to Washington, D.C. to pick up a prestigious award he's received from the Smithsonian, whose scientists are obviously unaware that this brilliant mapmaker is only 12. We also don't know for a while where we are in time. It feels like Mark Twain, as T.S. maps out his sister shucking corn, for instance. But it's actually set in contemporary America. So when we spoke with Rafe Larson last May, we asked him, when he was writing this, what was he feeling about time?
I wanted to give it that kind of shimmer of timelessness that certain Westerns have. You know, you're not sure where they take place. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the American West in general has that kind of almost fairy tale-like quality. Like, it could have happened 1,000 years ago. It could have happened now. It could happen in the future.
Right. Who is T.S.? Is this a boy you knew growing up? Is this a character, someone you knew?
People have asked me a lot, you know, are you T.S.? And
that's
kind
of what I'm asking.
Yeah, I kind of sense that. And I guess I had, you know, elements of him in me. And I wanted in some ways to be like a T.S. character in that I would keep my own record of the world in my bedroom, but mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't that disciplined. I do share a kind of intense love of maps that T.S. and I both have. But, you know, I've always been interested in kids that possess a couple extraordinary abilities that kind of baffle the world of adults around them. And so whenever I meet a kid like that, I kind of pay extra close attention.
Well, as we should, and as I was reading the book, and we should say the maps are, well, here's one of two hands. You see a whole panel of hands. It's sort of on graph paper with charts and arrows and things, and it's T.S.'s illustration of nervous Itsy Bitsy. It's his hands when he does the Itsy Bitsy spider, so he's graphed that out on graph paper. They're more artwork. And as I was reading, I was thinking, wow, who's this illustrator? It's you.
Yes, it is. And I actually wrote the book almost entirely without illustrations. I had a couple illustrations. I asked a couple of my friends to make some illustrations for it. And then I eventually realized, you know what, I have to do this myself because I'd probably drive the person who would illustrate this book crazy mm-hmm. with all my many, many requests.
It's in the margins, in these maps in the margins that contain the information from the drawings and then also notes. On page 11 here, it's in this margin that we first learn about the event that hangs over the whole family, which is that Leighton was killed in an accident with a gun. T.S. was there. It was in the barn.
Yeah. You know, from my point of view, the relationship between the margins and the main text was one of the biggest challenges from the book. And I think the reader will realize quickly that they can't skip the marginalia. And in fact, that's where T.S. is almost the most comfortable, and he'll make these reveals or give these kind of emotional declarations that he wouldn't otherwise in the main text. They're often hidden in the last line of a sidebar.
Right. Well, and we also learn that part of what's happening to T.S. emotionally is it has to do with Newton's law of physics. He quotes Newton quite a bit. He fiercely believes that every force demands an equal and relative force. So he is sort of waiting for the force to hit him after his brother's death. I mean, he's assuming something's going to happen to him.
Yeah, I mean, he has this tremendous guilt that why was it Leighton that met this end in the barn when Leighton is kind of the cowboy son that the father so revered and T.S. is the odd bird on this ranch, although there's a lot of odd birds on this ranch. I think that T.S., over the course of the book, comes to a new understanding of Newton. I personally love that he's obsessed with Newton as the rest of the scientific world has moved on. You know, T.S. gets hung up on these things. He hasn't moved to computers. He hasn't moved to quantum mechanics. He's still rooted in the past in many ways, which is kind of lovable about him, I think.
We don't want to give away the end of the story, except to say what? Rafe Larson, what would you say about what T.S. learns at the end of his journey?
Things start to go awry, and T.S., who we have come to know as this intense observational empiricist who records kind of everything, I think when he's confronted with the world of adults who start to become obsessed with him in this way, it's the adults, it's not the kids, that make him kind of turn back into almost a kid again. But in doing so, I think he he comes to terms with some big questions that he has been struggling with.
Mm. Well, Rafe Larson, as we said, it launched a bidding war, I think was $900,000 publishing deal. Your debut novel. Are you surprised by this?
Oh, I had really modest expectations going into this. I mean, it's such a strange creature of a book in many ways. It's a weird shape. It has all these arrows popping out of it everywhere, and it's not necessarily like other books you would see. So I wanted it to be launched into the world in the way that it wanted to be, and then I wanted to be able to write another book. So all my expectations have been definitely met in that regard.
And did you want to sort of, you know, give a hurrah to, well, you've said this of yourself, to nerdy kids everywhere who might be, you know, using protractors and making maps on graph paper and keeping notebooks in their room while everybody else is on the computer?
Oh, yes. I'm a champion of nerds. I think they make the world go round. And I think, you know, most people are nerdish, whether they would admit it or not. We all have these little obsessive tendencies. And I think those are the tendencies that I'm most interested in.
And also, the very last words, almost, just about, I mean, you thank your family at the end, but the very last words of the book are thanks to your seventh grade teacher.
Yes. Lois Hetland is a, she was a teacher of mine, and she's gone on to get a PhD in learning theory, and she works in arts and education. And I'm grateful to, you know, all my teachers, and particularly the ones that allowed me. I was the type of student who the busy work I wasn't so good at, but when I really sunk my teeth into a project, I would take it, you know, all the way and then some. And I was grateful to the teachers that saw that instinct in me and allowed it to thrive. I think good teaching is about good listening, and I've been so fortunate to have some really great teachers.